From the land of Grand University at Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 28th day of March 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Jackie Vake. She's from Stuart Peterson. A bit later in the program, we'll get an update of the agricultural news for the afternoon. We'll hear a bit about Easter and opening day. How many hot dogs do you think might be eaten across the nation during baseball season? We'll have that number for you. And as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast, too, with Drew Lerner. He's at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. And it all happens on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online, listen to us on demand anytime you'd like, as a podcast at willag.org in iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and one of my favorite ways, by using the NPR One app.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Of course, you're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. We're now joined by Jackie Vake. She's at Stuart Peterson. Hey, good afternoon to you, Jackie. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon, Todd. Glad to be here.
So today was, I think, relatively quiet in Chicago, but it is, of course, the day before the USDA acreage and grain stocks reports. Those are due out at 11 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Right. Yeah, today was kind of like watching paint dry. Yeah, that's about as much action as there really was. It wasn't much. When I look at some of the key resistance and support levels, there were some interesting things there. Maycorn was trading below the 50-day moving average at 375.25 and actually closed at 373.5, like you said just before. That was, that's resistance. And after that, you know, we've got resistance at 376, 383, and support is down there at 369.25, which really isn't that far away, 4 cents. Major support, 359. Now, that's the 138% retracement from the 395.75 high that we had, down to that 369.25 low. As I look to the December corn, we've got a double bottom. How about that? I hope it works at 395.25. Resistance is 397.5 there too. You know, we only have 2 cents, but support is down at the 200-day moving average, which is that 397.5 is, excuse me, that's not support. That is resistance. Support is down at 391, which is 100-day. When you look at the beans, on May, we've got resistance there. You know, we close at 1018, but resistance is really at 1032, 1043, 1054, and then support at 1010 and down at the $10.75 level, which is the 200-day moving average. Now, November's the one that was kind of interesting. It broke and it closed below the 50-day moving average. I was very disappointed in that particular contract. We closed at 1016 and a quarter. That 50-day moving average is at 1019.875, so that now becomes resistance. But that 50-day had held 2 out of the last 3 sessions, and I was hoping we'd be able to make it through today, but I think it's just a reflection of what people are thinking about the report. We've got overhead resistance at 1033 right now in November, and major support down there at $10.03, so that's the 100-day moving average. It's going to be interesting. I'll be glad to have the reports over.
Have you been watching any of the outside markets closely?
Well, like always, I watch the dollar, you know, and the dollar was interesting today for the longest time. It was trading and tried to push its way through the 10, 20, 40, and 50-day moving average, and then finally achieved it. And so we're up around 90.06 at the moment, and 90.4 is really resistance. We're still competitive at this level, but, you know, we need to find ourselves in a way that are in a spot that's going to be more competitive than that.
You know, exports are awfully important. In your opinion, where do we stand?
Well, this is the concerning part. And, you know, something for a lot of us and for a long time, I think a lot of people wondered about beans. You know, we know that the potential for higher bean acres is here. We know that Brazil is doing well in beans. Argentina is not so well. But I thought I was going to look at export sales versus inspections and just kind of give the people who listen an idea of where we're at. A lot of people get wrapped up in sales. Okay, sales is not what counts. What it counts is what's inspected. In other words, what leaves the port. Sales can always be rolled forward and sales can always be canceled. But for corn so far, we've got 1.775 billion bushels sold. We've only shipped 902 million out of that. We're in the 29th week of the marketing year. So we're 56% of the way through the marketing year. and we've only shipped 40.5% of USDA expectation, which is at $2.225 billion. You can see why speculators and traders might look at that and say, I'm not so sure I'm going to jump on board just yet. Now, beans, totally different story. Sales of 1.838, shipped 1.5, again, 56% through the marketing year, and that means that we've shipped 72.6% of the 2.065 billion bushels the USDA is expecting. So, you know, that's why I think beans have been resilient, is just because we are doing that well on inspections. When you look at wheat, basically 825 million in sales, 715 delivered. We're in the 42nd week, and we are at 77.3% of the 925 million that the USDA expects. You know, so in the next 10 weeks, we're going to have to move right along here, but at the same time, they're not bad either. It's really the corn that's been dogging it when you look at the inspections.
Tomorrow, USDA will release the acreage and grain stocks numbers. Do you have some trade estimates?
Well, I certainly do, you know, and let's hope. Well, I think they'll be close, to be absolutely honest with you. You know, when you look at the average estimate for the grain stocks, and to me, grain stocks is much more important than acreage, but they're saying 8.7 billion for corn. Now, last year in March, we had 8.62, and so in other words, this year they're expecting the stocks to be 69.5% of the total crop, and that's just where we were last year. So if we come in at 8.7, I don't think it's going to be as negative to the market as some people might think. On beans, they're expecting 2.03 billion. Last year we had 1.739 billion, and so this year they're expecting 64% of the crop is going to still be there in stocks versus 60% last year. And on wheat, we're expecting 66% of this year's crop to be there versus 65% last year. So actually, in this scenario, beans has a little more negative situation. In other words, not as much, the expectation is not for as much disappearance as you might think that there should be. When I look at the acreage, that's going to be interesting. You know, we're at the average guess is 89.42 for corn. Now, last year we had 90.167. The ag farm at 90 million, not a big surprise. I mean, they're always able to leave out quite a few acres, you know, and for people to be able to make up their mind, you know, they don't really know what's going on at that point in time. Soybeans, 91.05 are the guesses. Last year we had 90.14. So, you know, it's an increase of not quite a million acres, but I know I hear a lot of people out there saying they're expecting a 2 million acre increase. 90 million is where the farm was on that 2 week, 46.297 for all. Last year we were at 46. So a little more wheat planting is going on. And the other one I wanted to watch, Todd, was cotton. The average trade guess on cotton is for 13.3 million acres compared to 12.6. Now, that's 700,000 acres higher, and that's right on with what the USDA Outlook Forum said at 13.3. And the question there is going to be, where did the extra acres of cotton come from? Did they come from corn? I've heard from some of my guys in Texas, it's corn that went into cotton. Talking to one of my people in Louisiana, he said, we really can't expand a lot more cotton because we just don't have the ginners to be able to do it. So, you know, cotton and beans are really, they're just like a perfect match for each other because they use the, you know, the same type of herbicides, you know, and everything. And so a lot of times you expect it to seed to go to beans, but it doesn't seem to be that way necessarily this year. So tomorrow I'll answer a lot of those questions.
Indeed it will. Only about 45 seconds left. Any final thought?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm just going to throw something out there for the guys to think about. You know, the cost of transportation in Brazil. You know, we complain so much about shipping costs here. In Mato Grosso, to get beans to an export facility, it costs approximately 33% of the price of a bushel. So $10 beans, that's $3.30 to get it to the port. Corn is even worse at 80% of the value of a bushel. So can you even imagine, Todd, $3.20 of a $4 bushel corn for shipping? And do we have it good? You know, I think we've got a great, to be absolutely honest with you, you know, so.
Absolutely. Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. That, of course, is Jackie Vakes. She is with Stuart Peterson. In today's agricultural news, a just-released Purdue University study shows that Chinese soybean imports from the United States could drop by as much as 71% if China were to impose trade restrictions on U.S. soybeans, that in response to U.S. tariffs on Chinese products. However, the analysis has a wide range of results under different assumptions of protection rates. The best estimates of possible impacts of Chinese tariffs on soybean imports from the United States show that if the Chinese were to adopt a 10% tariff on U.S. soybeans, U.S. exports to that country could fall by 33%. In a scenario where China imposed a 30% tariff, Chinese imports of U.S. soybeans could drop by 71%. That would drop the total U.S. soybean exports globally by 40% and could impact U.S. soybean production, dropping it by at least 17%. The annual economic loss in the United States would range between $1.7 and $3.3 billion. Well, let's stay with production agriculture for just the moment. We'll come back here to the United States in the Delta region, where there has been a lot of rain. But according to agriculture meteorologist Brad Rippey at USDA, they're still getting a lot of field work done.
Look at Louisiana, where we see now 63% of the intended corn acreage planted. And just a week ago, that number was 8%. We also saw a big jump in the corn planting in Arkansas, going from 2% a week ago to a March 25th number of 18% of the acreage planted. Mississippi, no different, going from 6% to 28% planted.
Corn planting in the state of Texas set at 43%, though things are stalling out as rainfall has begun across a great deal of the region. Well, let's stay with corn for the moment, but we'll switch topics to the RFS. An RFS proposal apparently is almost ready for Mr. Trump. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue are expected to participate in a phone call with the White House staff sometime this week, according to Politico, to finalize a list of options for altering the renewable fuel standard to give to the president. The list is expected to reflect measures discussed at a March 1 White House meeting. Let's stay with the Environmental Protection Agency, which is now working to replace the Waters of the U.S. rule, or WOTUS, with a new rule by the end of this year. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt says the 2015 rule will soon officially be a thing of the past.
There are two steps that we've taken. One is to ensure that the 2015 rule never springs back into existence. So we've got rulemaking in place to rescind that, and that will be finalized early this year, I would say in the next month or two. And then we've got a substitute rule that's coming, a new definition that's consistent with Justice Scalia, the text of the statute, and the purposes behind the Clean Water Act, recognizing that puddles and dry creek beds and ephemeral drainage ditches aren't waters of the United States.
The EPA earlier this year moved to extend the start date for the 2015 rule, a move needed to continue a blockade of the rule following a Supreme Court ruling. A recent Supreme Court decision defined jurisdiction of the rule to federal district courts, not federal appeals courts, where a nationwide hold on WOTUS was placed in 2015. The Supreme Court action nullified the lower court delay, which could have allowed WOTUS to go into effect. A substitute rule will replace the 2015 rule while the EPA crafts a new WOTUS. The substitute rule, Pruitt says, will define what is and what is not considered a federal water.
We've traveled across the country, 30-plus states. We've learned from farmers and ranchers, private property owners, certain regional concerns about certain variations of land, like in North Dakota, prairie potholes were considered waters of the United States on the previous rule. We're going to have bright line exemptions or exceptions for those areas of the country where we know that those shouldn't be considered waters of the United States.
Previous rule, according to Pruitt, put the EPA in the driver's seat when it comes to regulating land use on public and private lands, including farms. Pruitt expects the new rule to be completed this year.
All finalized. The final definition will be finalized by the end of the year.
That's EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. Now let's move to trade, where CORUS is now in play. That's the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. The revised agreement seems to be a win for President Trump, whose unconventional approach to trade efforts is marked by tariff or other threats, followed by negotiations and then a squeeze at the bargaining table. It's an approach Trump used in getting Mexico and Canada into the new North American Free Trade Agreement talks, and one that had some farm state lawmakers like Missouri's Claire McCaskill squirming earlier.
I think it is throwing ag under the bus.
Former Department of Agriculture trade chief in the Clinton administration, Paul Drazik, argues South Korea was already willing to rework course before the steel tariffs were announced, and argues China's willingness to talk may result in very little.
If it works, more power to them. But I think it's bad negotiating tactics. I think, you know, it may work once. I don't know if it'll work twice. And I don't know how effective it's going to be in terms of the overall objective of getting the trade deficit to zero.
Drazik says it's easy to get the Chinese to come to the bargaining table. Still, all the trade skepticism from agriculture and other sectors has done nothing to dissuade the president and his advisors from keeping the pressure on, including continuing threats to withdraw from NAFTA. Nor has the White House yet exempted huge ag trading and security partner Japan from steel tariffs. And finally today, something a little lighter. Do you know how Easter got tied up with bunnies? Theories over the years have multiplied like rabbits, says USDA's Gary Crawford.
Well, only a few days left before we get a visit from that famous bunny.
Yes, Easter rabbit, hooray!
Bugs don't go there.
I don't think bugs symbolizes the things that the Easter Bunny was intended to symbolize.
That's Ann Eflin, historical expert with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So what has a bunny really got to do with Easter anyway? Well, first, Easter was around centuries before Christ.
Originally, it was a holiday that celebrated a Germanic goddess, Esther, or Easter.
Who was often pictured in early German culture as part rabbit. Then the bunny took on a life of its own again in ancient Germany.
The German story is that there was a poor woman who had decorated eggs for her family to find during a famine. When they found this nest of eggs and looked up, they saw a rabbit hopping away, and that's how they decided the rabbit had brought the eggs.
And that might just be where we get the Easter egg hunt and the Easter bunny.
Here's Easter.
And we don't mean you, Bugs.
Have an egg. Here's Easter.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
That's a look at today's agricultural news.
And that's all, folks.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. You know, tomorrow's opening day for Major League Baseball, a day that's the surest sign of spring. The warm sunshine, the smell of grass and dirt, the crack of the bat, the roar of the crowd, and the greatest sound of all, the hot dog vendor. Opening day is a big deal around the country. This is true especially for the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council. Organization President Eric Mettenthal, he's pretty excited.
Yeah, we think opening day should be a national holiday. It's that big of a day here in the U.S. And you know, it's a marriage of two American icons. Baseball and hot dogs just go together. And every year, fans flock to the ballparks. And when they go, they eat hot dogs.
Just think of it. 30 major league stadiums and thousands of people all ready to eat a hot dog or maybe a sausage.
We do an annual survey asking how many hot dogs baseball fans are anticipated to eat. And this year, fans are expected to eat more than 19 million hot dogs and 4.5 million sausages during the Major League Baseball season.
Of course, while you can get the plain Jane hot dog or sausage, every stadium has their own unique take on the cuisine. So what standouts are there for this season? Well, Mettenthal runs down one of the more interesting concoction.
I think the one that has gained the most attention so far is the Dilly Dog down in Texas. Well, the Rangers kind of lead the way in this area, and what they've done is they've hollowed out a dill pickle and stuffed a hot dog inside and then fried it. So it's kind of a corn dog pickle hot dog mixture, and sounds delicious.
Of course, the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council also has been hosting some spirited debates this month about hot dogs and sausages. Things like whether or not it's a hot dog or a sandwich. You can join these debates, learn more about hot dog and sausage etiquette, and find a ton more resources on their website at www.hot-dog.org. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner is here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Drew, let's start with the hard red winter wheat country. There's been on again, off again rainfall there. Is it enough, and where has it fallen?
Well, last night we were supposed to get some rain out of the Texas Panhandle, and we got a few showers, but they only turned out to be about a quarter of an inch of rain. And we do have one more chance for a little bit of moisture. This will occur overnight tonight, and we may see another opportunity for a quarter of an inch out in western Kansas, maybe the northernmost counties in the Texas Panhandle, and parts of northwestern Oklahoma. The bottom line, though, this isn't really a drought-busting rain, obviously, and the area still needs a significant drink of water, of which we probably aren't going to see for a while.
And then from there, let's go to other crops that need to be put in the ground earlier rather than later. I'm thinking the Dakotas, Minnesota, some of the spring-planted crops there.
Yes, the biggest issue there is the fact that it's still cold, and we still have snow on the ground, and we're going to see more snow accumulate as we go forward through this week. So fieldwork is going to be on hold for a while. We will probably warm up, but very slowly as we go into the latter part of the first week of April and on into the second week of April. So fieldwork is not going to advance very quickly, and some of those areas have substantial snows on the ground, and we are going to have to wait patiently for that to melt. It's interesting that we have this cold and wet bias in the northern U.S. plains. It's also present in Canada's prairies, and it's also present in Russia. So we may see a lot of places that get a little bit of a slow start this season.
Will that hold for the bulk of the Midwest, too?
Well, the Midwest, I think, is going to see a little less cold, but a little bit more rain. So it will be wet there, and delays are expected. I do not, at this point, expect to see a lot of very cold temperatures in the Midwest, maybe the upper portions of the region only. But the biggest issue is that we are going to see a frequent occurrence of rainfall as we move forward through April, and that's really going to limit the amount of time we have to get into some of these fields early.
Let's complete the circle of life in the United States, at least. Arkansas, the Delta region, they've been wet.
Yes, they have, but they did go through a week of favorable drying here recently, and I believe corn planting is actually a little bit ahead of schedule in Arkansas and parts of Mississippi, as well as some neighboring areas off to the south and west. But it is going to come to a roaring halt. We picked up on more rain across some of this region last night. There's not going to be another opportunity to dry down as significantly as they had for a while. We have some very heavy rain that are going to occur across the region over the next couple of days. Anywhere from 2 to 6 inches of rain will likely occur, and perhaps some localized amounts of 6 to 8 inches in a few counties. So flooding is going to be back once again like it was in late February.
And finally, a quick look into the Argentine cropping system.
Yeah, the situation there is unchanged, really. We're not getting any significant moisture to occur across the key production areas. Later this week, Friday into Saturday, we'll get a chance for some rain in the southwest, but that's not the heart of the soybean country, and only a minor amount of crops will probably benefit from that. And we'll probably have to wait yet another week before we get a better chance for rain down there as well.
Thanks so much.
Have a great day.
Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Of course, you've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find us online, listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. I'm UofI Extension's Todd Gleason.